This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
PC identity crises.
Rufus Climax Jim Nephew.
Post-war fantasy film essentials.
And occult immortality.
Ah, spring. Time for planting seeds and utter carnage in the garden.
Wait, what was that last one?
You heard me, Robin. It's time for some good old-fashioned garden warfare. Vicious Gardens is the new card game where you combine the joy of horticulture with the thrill of being a total jerk.
Okay, hold on. I thought you were talking about gardening.
We are, because in Vicious Gardens, you're not just planting petunias, my friend. You're sabotaging others in a cozy, cutthroat competition.
Okay, that sounds a bit intense for my usual pansies and peonies.
Oh, this is way beyond pansies, my friend. This is a battle for garden domination. You gotta sabotage your opponents, steal their plants, and choke out their prize-winning produce.
So it's a strategy game, but with plants?
You got it. Because the best gardeners are willing to get their hands dirty.
Okay, I'm strangely into this. Where can I join in the horticultural havoc?
Vicious Gardens is available now. Order yours at atlas-games.com. Then prepare for the meanest, greenest garden melee ever. The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the gaming hut where beloved Patreon backer Tennant Reed has been inspired by the recent film Companion. And so Tennant asks, if a GM wants to put players through a your character is not who slash what they thought they were scenario, where should they lean between rigorous pre-establishment of buy-in and preservation of the sense of surprise and vertigo they are presumably going for? Under what circumstances would you consider doing this in an existing campaign rather than a lower stakes one-shot? Robin, this is a version of the perennial question of buy-in or surprise. Both are important, which governs. And so, do you want to mention Companion real briefly for people who maybe haven't seen the Murder Sex Robot movie?
Right. So it's a super fun, entertaining science fiction horror film with a comedic edge, I guess somewhat in the Twilight Zone thing, but with a sort of an action thriller element and extremely well done. Sophie Thatcher turns in one of the great horror movie performances of all time as the girlfriend who seems to be like several degrees above the level of her schlumpy boyfriend, Josh, played by Jack Quaid. And you find out, and she finds out, not so far into it, that she's not who she thinks she is. She's a companion. And we won't give away much more than that, because if you haven't seen it, be sure to. And it's more fun when you know as little as possible what's going in, because it's a plot-oriented film. But we're giving away a little bit. Mm-hmm. So the question of whether to do this or not, I think there's two versions of it. The one-shot version, which is you are deciding to have this experience and sitting down at the table and handing out the pre-gens, and one or more of them reveal that the character is not only not who the other characters perceive them as, but not who they perceive themselves as. And you might have some sort of level of hint of that. And that's one in which you're leaning. It's not even so much toward buy-in or surprise as between the level of authorship that the player is exercising. That if you lean toward player's audience, you want them to be surprised by what the revelation is and then react accordingly and genuinely so that they don't have to pretend that they're surprised by the revelation. But in fact, they are genuinely surprised and reacting to it as the audience is in Companion, or toward the authorship side of things where it's like you and the player are collaborating in deciding to do this. You may leave some elements of it as a surprise, or perhaps even more intriguingly, as a thing to emerge and surprise you both during play. And I think this actually works super well, perhaps even better in extended play, because you have more time to draw it out and, you know, put in all the little pipe beats that set up what's going on and then have everybody surprised at the table when the thing happens. And in a one shot, it sort of kind of suggests that, well, everything is going to go the way it does in Companion,
which, right.
Again, not to spoil too much, is would be a great fiasco scenario.
Well, as you said at the top, it's a horror movie, so it does not go in the way of everyone sitting around and engaging in self-exploration, I assume.
Right, exactly. Now, many of our games can, and you will now elucidate which ones and why, come with this technology installed in the form of a drive or a peculiar thing. For example, A Trail of Cthulhu's In the Blood is set up to do exactly this. Why don't you explain how that works?
Yeah, In the Blood is a drive in Trail of Cthulhu, which is to say one of the things that motivates you. And the motivation turns out to be that you are not all human, that you are partially some kind of a monster or under some sort of curse. So it might be that you have been built by Yog-Sothoth as a vessel for your great-great-grandfather, who is a sorcerer. It might be that you have got a deep one taint in your family lineage. It might be that your old Uncle Steve used to take you out to the graveyard all the time was a ghoul. There's any number of ways in Lovecraft and the larger mythos for the outside to be in you, and that, in fact, was one of the things that Lovecraft was most terrified by, if you can go by his output. You know, and this would also cover, you used to be possessed by a great race of Yith, but then you forgot about it. Any of those sorts of things, which flows into the amnesia drive or thing that exists in Knight's Black Agents. You're not usually driven by amnesia, you're driven by mystery, but the mystery might be what happened during my amnesia. Jason Bourne, classically in the Bourne trilogy, is driven by that question, but you know, it might not be so simple as, oh, I was a government wet works experiment. It might, in fact, be I've been vampirized, or I've been exposed to vampirism, or I'm a government wet works experiment using vampire blood, or any number of horrible possibilities, because Knight's Black Agents is both a spy thriller and a horror game. So in general, I guess the lesson is that if you are in a horror game, you have expressed more buy-in to that sort of thing happening because, oh, I'm a werewolf. I guess that makes sense. That'll teach me to be absent on all those sessions that we played during the full moon, I guess. And then in other genres, it's maybe less expected or less accepted. I imagine that in an F20 game, a lot of it would depend on sort of the nature of magic and also sort of the relationship that you have with your players, because some players are very, very protective of their little piece because he's the only thing that they understand in a world of magic and mystery. Some players are, as you suggest, in more of an authorial stance there. Let's see what happens when he goes into this stress situation. And that's the kind of player that maybe is okay with being told, oh, you're a transformed mushroom and you've been walking around this whole time like you were a people, but actually you're a mushroom that got turned into a people by a wizard, and revelations follow from there.
Right. And 13th Age literally has a mechanism that allows players to do this if they want to, the one unique thing.
Yeah.
And quite often, even if it's not, you know, literally being a mushroom, the one unique thing often will suggest something that is unresolved or unknown that they are moving toward discovering. Mm-hmm. And especially in the F20 environment of 13th Age, the assumption is that the GM is going to be doing much more to deliver story to you, and you're kind of asking to be surprised, right? You're buying an Archie McPhee grab bag and mm-hmm. hoping that the GM put something fun and interesting in it. And that can be something outlandish, like being a mushroom, or it can simply be, I'm an orphan of uncertain parentage, but I had a strange ornate ring with me, apparently, when I was left on the doorstep of the orc orphanage, and I wonder what that could mean. And you, as a player, then can look for ways to remind the GM to do that and bring that back in. And, you know, you go to the new city and you enter the orc neighborhood and you see, you can ask the GM, hey, are there any insignia around here that, you know, resemble the description of the ring that I got? Or, you know, can I go to the jewelers and ask him about this ring and what the details could be? So you can, to turn this around a bit, as a player, you can look to be proactive in bringing that about and not relying on the GM to remember to do it or to find spaces to do it. and you can try to help them provide opportunities to sort of slowly introduce the revelation over time. And the obvious thing, of course, is that, you know, you would be the heir to an orc kingdom, but maybe they can come up with something different to surprise you or throw you for a loop, or they can give you sort of a red herring where initially it's like, oh yeah, that's an entrance to a dungeon. What could be more F20 than that? And then you find the dungeon, and then of course you, oh right, of course. But when you're in the dungeon, you find out that you're, the heir to the orc kingdom.
I think a lot of it is, it will be more acceptable if it's within genre norms. And even in regular D&D, people used to, you know, blue book their character past and give the GM a bunch of hooks. And a lot of that was implicit buy-in or even explicit buy-in to the notion of change of your character. I think the degree to which the character revelation is a shock is maybe genre dependent, in the sense that more horror-y your game, the more on brand it will be to shock the player with the revelation about their character than in F20. You know, you discovered you're a mushroom, you discovered you're a warforged, or you discovered whatever. You're not meant to respond with existential terror. You're meant to respond with, cool, does that mean I have powers? Am I the map to a treasure? Is, you know, that sort of question. And so if the goal is to create shock and horror at the table, I think the answer is, of course, try to keep it to horror games until your table trusts you to run shock and horror scenarios in other milieu. I guess if you were running a sort of a transhuman or cyberpunky type future game, that'd be the other possibility, where your personality was downloaded from a computer or bought from, you know, personality Timu by your mom or whatever, and the whole notion of personhood becomes a question in cyberpunk and transhuman games. So again, it's back into genre, even if the revelation, like in F20, is more mystery than it is shock and horror, right?
Right. And I guess, you know, again, a more mundane version of this that works in any genre is, you don't know who your true parents are, so you discover that, you know, Darth Vader is your father.
Right.
And yeah. So that's something that can be played for shock and horror, or slapping your forehead at the obviousness of course the GM did that. They made the big bad my dad. And again, it's all about the question of how much the player is just coming up with a very clever series of plot hooks, and how much it is that they are trying to themselves be surprised by what it is that you're throwing at them. And the key thing then is to sort of get a sense of, is the player trying to set up something where they know what the answer is? And I, you know, ran into this in a drama system game where I initially assumed that the player wanted me to build on a secret that they wanted to set up, but it turned out, oh no, they had a specific thing that they wanted to do. And so when you find that out as GM, that they are planning to surprise everyone else with the revelation instead of be surprised themselves, of course, that requires a completely different response, which is to pay attention to what it is that they're doing and to not step on whatever that is.
Right. That's where you lean in to the thing.
Right. And so that's not exactly the same as them not knowing who they really are. They know who they really are, and they're going to reveal that later on. But it functions in the same way at the table, in terms of your either the player is providing opportunities to have little bits of reveal and then have the big reveal, or is relying on you to have them have opportunities to do that. So I think at this point, the thing that we've discovered about this segment is that what it really is over. But excitingly, another segment waits on the other side of this here commercial. ...1968.
Sinister influences threaten to corrupt America from within and without.
The federal government establishes a new agency for overseas covert action.
The Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, the BNDD.
And within it, the forces of Delta Green.
In the Borealis Connection, the new globe-spanning mega-campaign for the fall of Delta Green, you become the mythos hunting agents hidden inside the BNDD.
Play 8 linked operations.
As separate standalones.
Or linked into an epic hunt for an infamous target.
Escort a sniper carrying a death warrant for a Shan warlord.
Surveil a Saigon drug summit.
Track heroin couriers on a flight from Hong Kong to L.A.
Investigate the disappearance of an archaeologist working the Bozukepi ceremonial site.
Smash a Beirut drug deal.
ID the actors broadcasting the Necronomicon from a CIA-backed Munich radio station.
And wage the drug war amid France's May 68 riots.
Designed by Kenneth Haidt.
Written by Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
The team that brought you the Zelazny Quartet and the Dracula Dossier.
The Borellis Connection.
Gorgeously designed and horrifically illustrated by Jen McCleary.
A tale of sordid intrigue.
Cosmic horror.
And desperate action against the mythos.
Now available in Titanic hardback.
From specially cleared gaming retail stores.
And the Pelgrane Press web store.
Now also at the web store as an instantly available PDF-only purchase.
It's time once more to reach back into the annals of perfidy to pull out the files of Crime and Punishment, because we're once more looking at the crime blotter. And this time we're looking at an old-timey Old West version of the crime blotter, because we're going to look at the career of, we often handle kind of dark figures in this segment, and instead we have a colorful, picaresque criminal. We have Rufus Climax Jim Nephew, I think the third most famous nephew to listeners of this podcast.
Yeah, easily.
Easily. So let's, Ken, go back in time to this prolific, mostly cattle rustler, but he had some other skills as well.
Yeah, and I want to sort of preface this, that there are some actual census records. He's not a complete figment, but based on everything that I've read about this guy, I feel like we are dealing with a sort of a UFO, in the sense that we're dealing with something that when the newspapers are writing about him, they are not feeling it is their duty to inform the public of the truth so much as they're feeling that it would be fun to make up things about Rufus Climax Jim Nephew. He is, as you will see as we get into this, already sort of a larger-than-life figure, and he is slotting so clearly into the folkloric trickster figure that I cannot believe that this is more a story about loose standards of territorial Arizona journalism than it is about an outlaw. But that
just,
said,
after some prefatory fun ruining.
Right. That said, let us print the legend. He is possibly Canadian or French by ancestry. He is born Rutherford Nephew in Washington, D.C. in 1876, named after the president-elect, as it transpired. Apparently, and here's where the mything begins, he was apparently accidentally baptized Rufus, and apparently the church can't undo that when they make a mistake. So we're already off in the realm of what the hell. His father was a Civil War veteran from a Vermont regiment assigned to the DC defenses, which is how a possibly French Canadian guy gets to DC. His father dies in 1881 from lung trouble left over from the war. Mom moves the family to Chicago, but young Rufus keeps on going to Arizona, and he's traveling under the name Jim Thomas, aka Kid Thomas, and he shows up at the Hash Knife Ranch, and he has 12 pounds of Climax brand chewing tobacco in his bindle. And he is originally sort of a hobo cowboy, but eventually he starts riding with the group, and the Hash Knife Cowboys name him Climax Jim because the 12 pounds was gone by the end of the first range ride. And they're like, you sure do like that Climax tobacco, Climax Jim. So that, by the way, is the Grand Old Chew.
And so, emboldened by having a new nickname, he decides to go into some lines of business, and he becomes a butcher, which, of course, as we all know, leads into cattle rustling and horse thievery.
Yeah, or vice versa. He becomes a butcher to cover up the fact that he's a cattle rustler, which is, I guess, you know, vertical integration. So good for Climax Jim. His line that was quoted in one of these many newspaper interviews that he gave during his career, the cows were so poor looking, I was being charitable by relieving their owners of the responsibility of caring for them.
That does have a bit of the ring of the Frontier newspaper man about it.
Exactly. So his first known criminal offense is that he sold a dozen rustled steers to a slaughterhouse in Winslow, Arizona. This is when he's 17. He tunnels out of the jail at Winslow with a pocket knife because the jail is made of adobe and they don't search it when they let him in the jail, I guess. Or they don't imagine that a 17-year-old can concentrate that long on anything. A later jail, he tunnels out with a spoon, either again through an adobe wall or by prying the mortar out of the bricks, Count of Monte Cristo style, but don't leave him with an implement, I think is a lesson.
Right, especially in a relatively soft jail cell with mortar or adobe or something.
Right. In 1894, again, this is right around when he's 17, 18, he is sent to the Yuma Territorial Prison, and he served a year there and said later that it was the only jail in the territory he hadn't broken out of. And he was famous for his escapes. At one point in 1899, this is one of his greatest exploits, he escaped custody in Springerville, nude on horseback. And there are three different versions of the story. One, that he just feigns going crazy in his cell and starts taking his clothes off. And when the deputies crowd around to see what happens, he throws his pants in their face and runs.
In 1899, the pants in the face trick was new. So
it was new. They did not know it. The better version is that he smelled terrible either when they arrested him or shortly after being imprisoned. And they said, man, you smell terrible. He says, well, whose fault is that? You didn't give me a bath. So they take him to a horse trough. They're not going to take him to a nice bath. They give him a cake of soap and a brush and they dump him naked in the horse trough and they say, all right, wash yourself. And he sees, you will never believe this, Robin, a horse at the horse trough and steals the horse and rides away naked. And as the newspapers say, he did Lady Godiva one better because he rode through two towns naked instead of just one. He did later on claim to have been in the Red Pipkin gang, who were harder core rustlers and thieves and train robbers. In 1898, I don't know that he was, but I don't know that he wasn't. Certainly in 1899, he is arrested again for double burning the brands on cattle. And this is where when you get a cow and he's got the brand of another ranch, let us say the CCC ranch, you simply imagine a brand that would go over that CCC ranch, such as the Star Bar Circle brand, which is one that he used because it went over a lot of brands. And then you sell those cattle into Mexico because you are the head of the Star Bar Circle Ranch. Ask anyone. I even have business cards printed up, which he did.
Yes, by a weird coincidence, it's the most universally coverable over other brands brand, but that's my stock and trade.
Yeah, I mean, all the good brands were taken. I was a latecomer to this territory, sir. Later stories ascribe various feats of strength to him, that he would be in leg irons and break out. He would be in handcuffs and break them. He would bend jail bars. Again, I suspect the jail bars were set in adobe, and so he didn't so much bend them as chisel them out and shove them out of the way. But he was also, and this is more well attested, I don't say more accurate, a gifted lockpick. And so he could pick anything he couldn't snap. So basically, it was very tough to keep him in jail. Sometimes he would just undo the jail cell and then sit in the sheriff's chair until the sheriff came back in the morning. And he'd say, morning, sheriff, made the coffee. And everyone would have a good laugh. But often he would be chained up to a deputy and the deputy would be doing something. And then the deputy would wake up and find out he's chained to his own leg instead. And Climax Jim would be over the horizon. In 1902, for example, he was at the railway station and a burglar proof safe was being delivered to a shopkeeper, and the shopkeeper didn't come by to pick it up immediately. So because he was bored, Climax Jim opened the burglar proof safe. This is how he gets charged with burglary a lot, is doing this kind of thing.
Right. And according to at least the version of the story I read, he didn't he didn't crack the safe. He just twiddled the dial enough to figure out what the combination was. And
right,
so,
yeah, the old-fashioned sort of safe cracking.
Yeah. Now, is it set at 000 straight from the factory? That would ruin the story now, wouldn't it?
That would ruin the story, and how dare you? At one point, he has a little homestead, and he is suspected in a series of burglaries, and the sheriff's deputies show up, and they see him frantically throwing dirt into his well. And they say, aha, stand back. And they dig out his well for him because he actually just wanted the well dug out. And
Yes, they, and then he points to his ghostwriter, Mark Twain, for assist on that one.
He is also slippery in court, and I think this, the technical way that he was slippery in court is he just had a lot of friends. And so if one of his friends was supposed to be the witness against him, or worse yet, had come forward and said, I'll be the witness against Climax Jim, then they just wouldn't show up in court. They'd be out of town that day. Or he would have friends that would perjure themselves and swear he had nothing to do with it. It is an old saying, says the newspaper, that the third time is the charm, but Climax has been arrested and tried about 47 times, and he has always succeeded in getting in the clear. One lovely story is that he stole a bunch of cattle in Graham County. He's arrested in Graham County, put on trial, and he brings a bunch of witnesses to say, well, those cattle were stolen in Apache County. You don't have jurisdiction. So he's declared not guilty of the theft. The deputy from Apache County is right there. They arrest him, take him to trial in Apache County. A new batch of witnesses shows up and says, no, those cattle were all stolen over in Graham County. I don't know what you're talking about. So both cases dismissed. The classic Climax Jim story comes in Clifton, Arizona. This is in 1906 or 1907, so it's sort of towards the end of his career. And by the way, to paint a picture, Climax Jim is a good-looking young Sam Elliott type of guy. He's got a big mustache.
He's sort of a merger between Sam Elliott and Kurt Russell with a big old handlebar mustache. And the main photo of him that we have, he's got a quite luxurious frontier mullet. And I guess there isn't a big culminating incident in this, and he doesn't murder anybody. So, but you really feel like there should be, you know, at least a Western comedy about this guy.
Doesn't even seem to have ever carried a gun as far as anyone knows, except maybe, you know, a rifle when he was cowboying, honestly. Anyway, he had rustled a bunch of cattle, taken them to Clifton, Arizona, sold them to a butcher. The butcher wrote him a check. He did not like the price he got for his rustled cattle, so he had just adjusted the check. I assume, like, put a one in the front of the number and then cashed it. And then the butcher, you know, yells. So he's arrested for forging this check. He's sitting in court. They back and forth about his low character. The judge is like, this is not relevant to the case. The only thing important in this case is the check. Where's the check? And they all look around and they can't find the check. Just good old Climax Jim chewing his chewing tobacco there.
Chewing tobacco made this trick a lot easier back in the day.
Exactly. And everyone's like, well, I guess you don't have any evidence. Case dismissed. And Climax Jim gets up and, according to legend, spits out the combination chewed up check and tobacco in the judge's spittoon. I believe that Climax Jim may have actually spat it out somewhere else, but the story is good that way. The way that he's apprehended, by the way, to be brought to trial for this is an even better story. And it is that Deputy Sheriff Crookneck Johnson, chasing him down for either the cattle rustling or the check kiting, trailed him to the edge of Alkali Flat, which is between Clifton and the border. And on Alkali Flat, there's no trail. You don't leave a trail. The alkali sands are too hard. So he doesn't know where Climax Jim is ridden. He's sitting there and a mirage comes up. And in the mirage, which of course is just a reflection of what's farther over the horizon, he sees Climax Jim sleeping and he rides to the location in the mirage and arrests him. So I love the idea that this guy is so tricky that only a mirage can capture him.
This is definitely the Coen brothers version of his life.
He briefly tries to go straight and raise cattle, or is briefly not being caught as much and raise cattle. He was rustled during that period in 1901 and considered it a pretty low down trick to the papers. May have married a lady named Virginia Gonzalez in 1907. If so, that marriage did not last because we have an actual marriage certificate of marrying Gertrude Nephew, possibly a cousin, a woman also from DC, later identified in the legend as a school teacher. And that's in 1910, definitely marries her, has three kids, eventually sells out his homestead to a mining concern for 10 grand because he cleverly bought near a copper mine, and then moved to California and turned over a new leaf and professionally dug wells using his great strength, I guess. He is drafted in 1918, but he doesn't serve. But we do have a draft record that describes him. And then in 1921, in San Diego, He is digging a well and at age 44 either falls off of a scaffolding set up inside the well, or he's down in the well and the scaffolding falls and kills him. But one does imagine that some Navajo wise woman, when he has wrestled all the Navajo ponies back in the day, saying, "You're going to die on the scaffold." And he says, "No, I'm not." But sure enough, the old wise woman was correct, because he does, in fact, die at least under a scaffold, which is almost as good.
So the most obvious gaming application of Climax Gym is just to steal him and use him as a player character. You got to buy high strength, good lockpicking skill, your very chicanery-related interpersonal skills, and some contacts and stuff. And I think he would be a fine, entertaining version of, you know, the Western rogue, the thief character in your Western party.
Mm-hmm.
Also, he seems like the perfect sort of scoundrel character who knows something that you, the heroes, have to find out about, and you've got to track him down, and he's busy being on the lamp from the law, or perhaps you need to supply him with a spoon to dig him out of the adobe prison, or in a Weird West game, you have to cast the spell that causes gives him the strength that allows him to bend the bars to get out. And you can then, after solving the problem of helping him, he helps you by giving you the information you need.
Yeah. Or, you know, he just needs you to testify in court that he was nowhere near Graham County during that incident. And how dare they? And then that's an easy favor. And he is always looking for folks to help him out. There is a real...
Yeah, that's the favor you have the player characters do if you're running short on time.
Right, yeah.
Cut out the fun obstacles of just a little light perjury, as it were.
Just a little fun perjury to get everything set up. He is very much a sort of a Robin Hood character, I think, because he's not part of the giant cattle combines and he is predating on them. He's not giving the money to the poor or anything ridiculous like that, but he's definitely got the sort of he's our outlaw vibe. I think even at the time, the newspapers merely sort of blow that up into a big, good story. But clearly, a guy who gets off for 47 different counts of cattle rustling has got community sentiment on his side. Let's say that, right? Because if he'd really been a bad dude, at some level, he would have stolen the wrong guy's horse and been shot, and that would have been the end of it, right?
Right. Well, nephews are wily.
Yes,
and they are. All of his charms are, you know, relatively charming. None of them rise to the level, for example, of some of the scripts Michelle Nephew writes for us. So we can tip our Western hats to good old Climax Gym Nephew. And so let's mosey on down and see what other hut and or segment waits for us on the other side. In the spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral in the Delta Green campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Keep this podcast's cattle unrustled by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Kevin J. Maroney,
Adam Balderstone,
Ben Brigoff,
Chris Huning,
and Christopher Larrick.
The whir of the projector, the smell of the popcorn, and the sticky sensation under our feet welcome us once more into the center seats of the center aisle of the Cinema Hut, where we're settling back in for our Fantasy Film Essentials series. And as the 1940s slowly progress, we discover there are no shortage of ways to talk about ghosts coming back from the dead, often with a romantic angle to them. That seems to be the vibe. I don't know if they got it all out of their system, because I don't remember half of every movie in my youth being about ghosts and the dead, although there was a number of remakes of these movies, in fact, right, by the 80s.
Well, if you ask yourself the question, why are people trying to soften death in 1946?
I feel like the answer is clear.
Yeah. In our horror series, we had a lot of highfalutin explanations for all of the different fears that were being reflected in all of the different horror films. And when it comes to fantasy, a fantasy being a way of escaping and lightening and ameliorating real life tragedies, we don't need to explain that much, because it's pretty evident what's going on. And almost every film we're going to talk about today is from 1946. So these are films that were released post-war, which meant that they went into planning during the final years of the war.
So speaking of ghosts, then, our first ghost is from France. It is a Sylvie et le Fantôme, or Sylvia and the Ghost, by Claude Autant, Laura, and Robin. This is the first of the many ghost movies that you have been pinned to the Criterion Channel or the VCR or whatever it is to watch. So fill us in.
So this is a really charming comedy that does not directly reference the war, but is clearly about trying to heal from the war. So it has your archetypal cash-strapped noble who has a noble estate. He doesn't want to sell the estate, so he has to let go of a painting of the White Hunter, a figure from the castle's glorious past that his beloved teen daughter, played by Odette Joyeux, fantasizes about and identifies with. And she's like 16, and she is really into this noble, but he has to sell the giant painting of her in order to get some cash. And as one does in a ghost comedy, he makes plans to hire an actor to appear at this big party where she'll be sort of coming out and play the part of the ghost. However, due to a series of farcical misunderstandings, not only the actor, but a young swain who's sweet on the girl and a thief, a young thief who's also kind of sweet on her, all show up and wind up all being hired to play the ghost. And of course, the additional complication is that the real ghost is also manifested on the scene with the taking of the painting. And the ghost is played by Jacques Tati, who will later become famous for his whimsical, quasi-silent comedy films of the 50s and 60s. And he can't affect much in his environment. He can sort of move objects around, and there's some comedy around that. And it's basically a door-slamming farce, except it's ghosts instead of infidelity. And it's charming and sweet and is exactly what you would need as balm for your soul at a theater in France in 1946 when you're trying to forget the fact that when you leave the theater, maybe the place you're in is kind of in ruins. So it's was new to me before I started researching possible titles for this, and it's absolutely an essential. Speaking of essential French films from 1946, this is the only one on our list that was directed by a playable character from Dreamhounds of Paris. And of course, that's Beauty and the Beast from 1946, directed by Jean Cocteau.
Yeah. And this is one that I saw back in the day. I don't think it has ever left me, not least because my buddy and roommate at the time and I would say bah! To each other whenever we needed anything done around the apartment. That was good fun. But it is simultaneously a sort of almost spectral version of the fairy tale, very sort of weird and dreamlike, and I don't want to say off-putting, but certainly, you know that a surrealist directed it, but it's also, it sort of goes out of its way to reassure you a little bit and say, don't worry, it's all just a movie. I'm not really trying to do this. So there's this sort of artificial stuff that is also sort of, I think, intentional as a way of sort of creating a sense of uncanny. Am I awake? Is this a dream? Is this just people in makeup? Or did I accidentally stumble into some sort of weird situation? And that look of the film, I think, is the thing about it that is really some of the best things in it, is the sort of the production design, the direction, lighting, all that stuff. The acting is fine. Jean Marais is both the Beast and also Belle's buddy, Avenant. And Josette Day is Belle. Her dad is Marcel André. None of these people are necessarily, you know, blowing up the screen, but it works
well.
Great.
I would take issue with you on Jean Marais. I think he's really great. He's a major French actor and also, incidentally, Cocteau's partner.
Oh, well, there we are. And I guess, you know, I mean, the Beast is certainly impressive. You know, when you see him, see the makeup, it's very, very cool, especially for 1946. But maybe that is just, you know, me paying more attention to the beauty than the Beast, which is maybe a thing that I was doing back then.
Right. The score is by Georges Auric, the French classical composer, and that also adds a lot to the film and its sort of magical sense. And you can, there's a really good version of his score redone by a more contemporary ensemble with great sound separated from the dialogue, which is also something you might want to reach for if you want to create a sophisticated fairy tale atmosphere with a hint of modernism about it at one of your gaming tables.
And like a lot of the best movies, it's got some fairly extensive location shooting. So it's shot, you know, in and around real French chateaus out in the French countryside. So it looks very fairy tale in a way that entirely studio films do not often. So I like that about it. And it is just a, you know, best, I'd say it is the best film made of Beauty and the Beast, though maybe not the best version of the fairy tale, if that makes sense.
Best fairy tale movie made for grown-ups anyway, period.
Certainly not animated, it's the best, I would say that. And it is, as I say, I saw it back in 1989 or something, and I still have memories of various scenes in it that are sort of stamped into my subconscious. So well done, Jean Cocteau. You knew what you were doing.
Right. And it's certainly his most accessible film. His other ones are much more experimental.
Right. Yeah. Which is another nice thing. But it's a great flaw, Robin, is no ghost. And so therefore we have to move to the legendary Michael Powell, who has the best ghost ever, I would say, David Niven in A Matter of Life and Death, also known as Stairway to Heaven, if we were not yet confusing people enough with changing titles of ghost movies, but there we are.
Yeah, it has the dumbest reason to have a bad alternate title, which is that it was released in the U.S. by rookie distributors who said that you couldn't have the word death in a movie title. People wouldn't show up for it. So this is praiseworthy for its beautiful, colorful cinematography. There's a famous black and white sequence that is set in a celestial realm, and they treated that in a particular way that gives it a spectral sort of view to it. David Niven is a squadron leader in a war. He's a pilot, and he gets on the horn with an American on the ground, and she's trying to talk him through, but he doesn't have a parachute, and his plane is on fire. And so, of course, he's destined for sudden and irrevocable death, except that the angelic figure, and just like in Here Comes Mr. Jordan, it has a number, Conductor 71, played by Mary Scoring. He fails to find him due to the fog. That's the most English reason to fail to collect the spirit ever. And so when he does finally catch up with him, David Carter, played by David Niven, argues that while I've already led more life on this world, I've fallen in love, I'm a totally different person, and therefore I should get to plead my case. And what procedures do you have for me to appeal my death since you failed to collect me? But this plot description doesn't really conjure the sort of magical, lyrical, delicate sense of this film, which is, you know, absolutely textually about healing from the war and overcoming death and believing in magic and the power of love.
And it does all of that with just effortless charm. This is one of those movies that when you watch it, you think, oh, what a lovely, light little thing. And then the more you think about when it was made, the situation, what the actual storyline, as you say, is, you can't believe that it felt so light when you were watching it. It's a real testament, I guess, to Michael Powell, first of all, but also to the ability of fantasy to literally take your mind off something. Because even when you're watching the movie, your mind's not on what the movie's about because you're so in love with the characters being in love. It's a great movie.
This is not only many people's favorite Michael Powell movie, it's many people's favorite movie, full stop. But definitely a fantasy essential. Now we're going to go off the beaten path a little bit to The Stone Flower from the Soviet Union, directed by Alexander Petushko. This director later makes V-I-Y, which we talked about in the Horror Essentials series and is probably his best known film. But this one is another great example of a straight up fairy tale, although there's levels of it that are, first of all, kind of nodding kind of heavily to a critique of the government, which is more dangerous in 1946 in the USSR than it is most times and places. But it's set in the Urals. And the most important thing in this movie is malachite carving. And the whole film revolves around that, but of course is also a metaphor for sticking to your artistic self-belief, even when others want you to take the easy way out. So a young malachite carver, which is like a green mineral, which is actually kind of dangerous to work with, is so obsessed with perfecting his craft that he forsakes his devoted fiance and instead begins to be lured into the woods by the mistress of the Copper Mountain, who's sort of halfway between a spirit and a goddess. He's hoping to gaze upon her stone flower, and she takes him into her supernatural underground lair. The sets on this are amazing, and they all sort of break away and move around in a practical way that's really interesting and beguiling. Very stealable for your next F20 dungeon. And it's about artistic obsession in a way that makes this a fairy tale for adults, not in terms of being, you know, mature subject matter, but in terms of being a thing that adults care about and children do not particularly care about. And like a lot of Russian films, including Russian fairy tale films, it does not really gild, but sort of leans into the brutality of life. And that, I think, also gives it a sort of a weight that balances its creepy visual beauty.
From the Soviet Union, we move back to America. And finally, out of 1946, this is a 1947 film by Henry Koster called The Bishop's Wife.
This also illustrates how fantasy films have a lot more sort of normie classics in them than the horror film list does. This is a film that you may watch with your family every few Christmases or so, or it may have been your mom's favorite film or your grandma's favorite film, or remain your favorite film as a classic film lover. And this is a love triangle in which Cary Grant has an advantage above being just Cary Grant. He's an angel named Dudley. David Niven, once again, shows up as a bishop, and he wants to build a cathedral. And he's so obsessed with building a cathedral that he's shutting out his beautiful, caring wife, played by Loretta Young. Dudley shows up to magically solve his problems with his angelic powers. But it's not the problem that David Niven wants solved. He doesn't want to build his cathedral, but he wants to lead the bishop back to the righteous path. And the way that he's going to do that is by basically blatantly flirting with his wife.
Well, if you're an angel that looks like Cary Grant, you've got a skill set and you might as well use it.
Yes. And so it's a charming film about a love triangle that can't really go anywhere because one of the points of the triangle is an angel. And it's charming without being cloying. It plays in a sort of a pop folk culture way with the angels and heaven and so forth, but it's not a devotional film. Therefore, it's a fantasy film for our purposes and a charming and fun one that if you haven't seen it with your family at Christmas and you watch Christmas movies, give yourself a treat and check it out. Bishop's Wife.
All right. With that, I'm afraid the projectionist is yelling at us to get out and let them clean the theater. So once more, we remove ourselves from the cinema hut and look at the posters in the aisle that possibly lead us into another segment.
The British are coming! The British are coming!
In Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated in Nations and Cannons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The new campaign guide, The American Crisis, War in the North, covers the early actions of the war with historical adventures, setting information, and a fiendish Hessian plot.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
Educators can get a copy of the core book for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The American Crisis is currently released as a PDF with physical pre-orders available.
Visit nationsandcannons.com to check out a free adventure chapter and the quick start guide.
It's time once more to wend our way up the crickety cobweb stairs. We're going to stop on the landing and wave at the portrait of the King of the Fire Salamanders. He's going to wink back because that's just the friendly sort of elemental he is. And then we're going to head on into the Edwardian parlor of the Consulting Occultist to answer a question by estimable Patreon backer Bob Grider, who says, I'm using Black Star Magic in my Yellow King campaign. Black Star Magic is the magic book. And want a death-defying sorcerer to feature prominently between segments. They've already killed him once without burning his library, and while I've already thought of becomes a spirit guide to a future protege and takes over someone who reads his personal diaries a la Tom Riddle, I'm curious if there are more interesting slash evocative methods of immortality in occult history. And Ken, it turns out that people who want to work magic very often want to live forever.
Yeah, although their methods are generally less cool than those posited by fantasy and horror writers. So interesting and evocative, I guess, is, you know, your mileage may vary. But the oldest immortality method is the good old elixir of life. It's a thing that you eat or drink that makes you immortal. And that goes all the way back to the good old Shamu Nikiti, the flower of the heartbeat or plant of the heartbeat that Gilgamesh tries to get from the bottom of the sea. And he gets it from the bottom of the sea. He says, I'm going to eat this plant, but first I'm going to set it down and take these stones off my feet. And when he does, a snake eats it. And then the snake says, I'm immortal, and runs away, or snakes away, rather.
Yeah, and that snake now is in a St. Augustine reptile park, cursing his fate.
Exactly. The alchemists of late antiquity came up with something called the red elixir, at roughly the same time the Chinese, famously Emperor Shi Huangdi, but lots of other famous Chinese guys are chasing the true cinnabar, which is the version of mercury that makes you immortal as opposed to poisons you to death. Later alchemists sort of combined those ideas into what we call the philosopher's stone now, but it's basically the same thing. Usually a tiny little bit. That's all you need to become immortal. And Nicolas Flamel, for example, made a tiny amount, but just enough for himself, his wife, and his cat, which shows that Nicolas Flamel, the only alchemist who knew what was important in life.
Right. And there's an ongoing theme about the Philosopher's Stone, which is that rubes think it's to turn base metals into gold, but the truly spiritually enlightened know it's all about immortality.
Right. Though it would also turn base metals to gold, but why would you use it for that when you could be making your cat immortal?
Exactly.
The Japanese have a kind of a mermaid called a ningyo that if you eat it, you become immortal, but as with many immortals, it's not a good gig because now mermaids are mad at you. And that, I guess, flips over into the next kind of immortal, which is a god or other figure curses slash blesses you with immortality. Endymion is given immortality, but he can't ever wake up. Tithonos is given immortality, but he's not given eternal youth, so he turns into a cricket. Aswatthama in the Mahabharata gets immortality, but he's cursed with it, and so he has to ooze horrible goo out of himself for all of time. Famously, the myth of the wandering Jew, the guy that makes fun of Christ when he's carrying the cross, and Christ says, oh yeah, so don't make fun of Christ. I think that's the message. And then we have various figures from legend or even fiction, like Hobgadling from the Sandman comics. Same deal. You have someone who's got the power of life and death in their gift, and they give it to you. And they give it to you good and hard, usually. Sometimes you don't have to meet someone or eat something. You have to go on a quest to get immortality, and that classically is the Holy Grail that used to do that. I guess not classically, but evilly. We know that Galahad and Percival achieve the Grail and go on to live in Grail country and probably die there. But Sir Bors the Younger achieves the Grail, and he's still narrating the Mort d'Arthur, so maybe he's immortal, who can say? Ponce de Leon famously goes in quest for the Fountain of Youth. He got shot with arrows, so apparently it's the Fountain of Youth, not the Fountain of Arrow-proofing.
That's a whole different fountain. It's not even anywhere near Florida.
Right, yeah. And Shambhala, the mystical land in Buddhist mythology, is meant at least to be a land where you're immortal while you're there, and that becomes Shangri-La in James Hilton's novel and the movie. So there is a land sometimes where you're immortal as long as you're there, and one can imagine that there is, you know, it is not unlike, let's say, the Lazarus Pit from good old Ra's al Ghul, that he keeps it there in his version of Shambhala, Nanga Parbat. Often, you can cleverly have your death put into a different thing, and then as long as that thing is safe, you're safe. Meleager famously has his death in a log, and when the log burns up, he will die, and his mom overhears the prophecy and hides the log, and so he's immortal until someone gets mad at him and burns his log. Koshchei the Deathless famously has his life hidden in an egg somewhere, and maybe the egg is made of emerald, or maybe it's just a regular old egg, but either way, Koshchei's not telling. You can have your personal descendant become the vessel for your immortality, and not in the good way, Joseph Kerwin style. You drop into them. His immortality is kept in an image, which is another fun place, I think, we're getting into sort of interesting and evocative immortality, is, oh, the painting, a good old Dorian Gray situation, where that's where your actual life is kept, and so you wander around. The kissing cousin of that is your reincarnation. There are a number of heroes from Indian legendary that deliberately reincarnate into the next life to accomplish a task, not usually to become immortal, just to, you know, overcome an obstacle in this life. They reincarnate and fix it. But Saint Germain, later Theosophist lore and Church Universal Triumphant lore, is reincarnating, not just immortal through alchemy, the way that he personally went around and said that he was. And then that leads into the legend of the walk-ins, which are these immortal spirits. And this is more sort of dark new age, but they walk in and take over your body and live your life. And then they're immortal. Your physical body isn't, but you know, you can have been, you know, Akhenaten in the past, and then you just keep walking in and doing stuff.
Right. So Yithians.
Yes, Yithians, or RPG Nephilim. And possession is, I guess, the way to reincarnate, and there's plenty of cases of the ghost that leaves the body of the dead guy and goes into the body of the living guy, and then they move on through life until it's time to move to another body, and that's a standard methodology, I suppose. More honored in occult fiction than I think in occultism per se, but there we are. And then as we move into the modern times, you don't need any of that shenanigans. You just believe hard enough that you're not going to die, and you won't. So Cagliostro in Theosophy is described as practicing a form of auto-redemption in which the magical will of a person captures his or her own immortality, obtains eternal life, and thus becomes sovereign and lord over life and over death. So you just go on your vision quest or your magical quest, your magical path working, and instead of getting knowledge and conversation of your holy guardian angel, you're like, I'm going to get knowledge and conversation of my own immortality.
Which I will then describe in these highfalutin theosophical terms, that it's hard to understand exactly what is happening or what you're talking about.
Yes. But the cool sort of M.R. Jamesian immortality, where you're in a clutch of spiders or in the pages of the Tractat Midoth or whatever else, that is mostly cool fiction as opposed to legitimate occultism. Although there's
right.
Nothing that says that one can't become the other.
Right. Well, speaking of cool fiction, Bob mentioned Black Star Magic, which is the book that explains how magic works in the Yellow King role-playing game. And corresponding to each of the four sequences or realities or eras of the game is a different form of magic. So in 1895 Paris, if you have a character there who you want to have become immortal and then continue to literally pester the characters again and again, that's the one that uses hermetic occultism as the basis for the way all of the different spells work. And so you can posit a spell that's perhaps out of the reach of the player characters, but that an antagonist could use. He would probably do the, you know, straight up European tradition thing. And so that would be some version of the Philosopher's Stone or something involving alchemy. In the wars, the alternate 1947 conflict with shattered reality and weird science, the Science Joan, the yellow science, could be a way of gaining immortality. And of course, in that setting, everything is bent toward warfare. So possibly the character would get a rejuvenation serum as part of a super soldier process, or just a soldier recycling process that after a while they need more bodies to throw onto the front lines. And so they start using the weird war technologies to resurrect soldiers and bring them back. And so your antagonist character may have been unwillingly dragooned back into the battlefield after dying in Aftermath, which is the alternate present after a 100-year dictatorship, the Castanes. The magic there is parageometry, where they sort of found the level of reality under our reality. They begin to manipulate the reality-shattering powers of Carcosa directly in a quasi-mathematical way. And so they might just rewrite the mathematics of aging. And of course, that would be most interesting to the Castanes themselves. And so perhaps they kept this secret from others. And maybe one of the dead emperors isn't so dead after all and is leading the charge from his secret location where he's really still alive. And in This Is Normal Now, magic is signing the ability to tap into Carcosa by manipulating memes and trends. So of course, immortality for them would be brought to you by wellness influencers who are clearly departing from reality, but in this version, to perhaps to an affectionate way that brings back one of the recurring villains or just makes you a vessel for a walk-in or a possession. There are certainly going to be transhumans trying to make themselves immortal, like the tech oligarchs we have who are transfusing themselves with the blood of the young, speaking of things that are straight out of horror literature, but actually are happening in our real world. Uh-huh. But also in Yellow King, there's just the idea that the groups of player characters through the four settings are themselves being reflected or reincarnated or are versions of their previous self. So it could just as easily be the case that the people that they are entangled with through their connection to Carcosa and to the play are also being brought back in different forms and versions. And it's just, you know, straight up the shattered metaphysics of Carcosa that keep bringing people back and reconfiguring them and making sure that it's extremely difficult to get rid of an ongoing villain.
You could even have a particularly desperate wellness influencer who has figured out somehow that these people's life threads have extended as far back as 1895 and believe that they're the secret to immortality, and they're hunting them down with all of their Simpson minions to get the player characters to cough up what their secret is, and their secret is their player characters, so it's uncoughable. But that doesn't mean that bad actors can't believe wrong things about you and then say it on YouTube. So, or
it could be achievable, right? That could in fact be something they could do if they catch you and boil you down. So you want to make sure that they don't.
Yeah.
Do that.
Well, you know, by the time you're boiled down, I suppose it's sort of immaterial to you whether they can actually do it. But it's certainly, yes, if you are facing an immortal bad guy who has, like you, been passing down through the eras and especially passed across worlds. I mean, maybe you think, well, at least we're shut of that guy. We're in the other world of This Is Normal Now, not the Castane world. But guess what? You're not. And maybe there is an immortality secret that everyone's after by then, or at least all the sort of people who are in on the Carcosan nature of reality are in on it in the same way that people in a Tim Powers novel are all always chasing ghosts or whatever.
Right. Well, just like the Yellow King game has four realities, this podcast has four segments. We've done four segments, so this podcast is done, but it's only done for this week. It's coming back immortally a week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Prevent this podcast from crumbling into thwarted immortality dust by joining such backers as
Ryan McClelland,
Tone Malazzo,
Tony Kemp,
Alex Johnston,
and David Mascari.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Grab our latest design, Subtlety is for People Who Forgot Their Battering Ram.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.